Everything is the same, even if it's different.
Exactly.
Coming up, it's Philosophy Talk.
We think everything is separate, limited. I'm over here, you're over there, which is true. But it's not the whole truth, because we're all connected.
In Sanskrit, the word Advaita refers to the belief that everything is one.
But if everything is one, then who are you? And who am I?
Well, if we actually exist and we're not just an illusion, then we're one and the same.
So I'm just talking to myself?
I am them. They are me. We are all singing. I have the mouth.
One life with each other. Sisters, brothers.
What is real only as a characteristic, as a specification of Brahman?
Our guest is Elisa Freschi from the University of Toronto.
It is existent consciousness and bliss.
Non-duality and the oneness of being.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Hey, philosopher. Just taking a moment to thank you for being a listener.
And asking you to please consider making an end-of-year gift to support the program so that we can continue to question everything.
Except your intelligence. This year, it's been everything from cancel culture to contradictions, from wise women to weird ones.
So head on over to our website, philosophytalk.org, and click Support Us at the top of the page.
Or give the gift of thought to the other philosopher in your life with a subscription to our library of nearly 600 episodes.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you for thinking.
And thank you for supporting Philosophy Talk.
What does it mean to say everything is one?
Doesn't it seem like there are many things?
Is separateness just an illusion?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. We're coming to you from our respective living rooms via the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Ray teaches philosophy and I direct the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today, we're thinking about non-duality and the oneness of being.
Lots of philosophers believe in the oneness of being in traditions from all around the world. But today we're going to focus mostly on Indian philosophy.
Yeah, it seems like even within Hinduism, there are a lot of different schools of thought. And they all understand oneness in what seem like slightly different ways. So I find it kind of confusing.
Well, the school I'm most familiar with, and I'm guessing the one our listeners might be most familiar with, is called Advaita Vedanta. And I think that view is at least relatively straightforward.
Okay, well, I know that Advaita means not two in Sanskrit, so that much is pretty clear. But the rest does not seem straightforward at all to me.
Well, that's a good start, actually. I mean, look, think about Descartes. He was a big dualist, right? He thought that the physical and spiritual worlds were fundamentally different.
Oh, yeah, yeah. For Descartes, there were two kinds of substance. There was consciousness and there was matter. And humans have a conscious mind and a material body. But how does any of that help me understand Advaita?
Well, as you said, Advaita means not to, so Advaita is a denial of dualism. There aren't two kinds of substance like Descartes thought, matter and consciousness. Instead, everything is pure consciousness.
Okay, so physical objects aren't real. They're just projections of our consciousness too?
Bingo.
Okay, so that's just what European philosophers would call idealism. But wait, that doesn't mean that everything is one. I mean, that's the part of Advaita philosophy I really don't get.
Yeah, you got it, right? It's not just that there's one kind of thing, it's that there's only one thing. It might look like there are many things, but ultimately that's just an illusion.
Okay, so I'm sitting here on a chair looking at you on my computer screen. But if I understand you correctly, you're saying that you, me, the chair, and the computer are actually all just one thing?
Well, sort of. If any of those things actually existed, then they would all be one thing, but they're not real, so...
Ah, what? You see why I'm confused by Advaita. So, okay, so you and I are not real, or we are real, but we're not two different things?
Yes.
Yes, which one? Look, we're either real or we're not. And if we're not real, then who am I arguing with?
Well, in Hindu philosophy, some branches at least, you and I are both souls, or Atman. And Brahman is the ultimate reality behind all the different objects we see. In Advaita philosophy, these two things, Atman and Brahman, they're not really two. They're really one.
Okay, I think I'm starting to get it now. So we don't exist as separate souls or like distinct egos. So you and I are not names for anything real?
Exactly. I mean, there's this perception we have that we're separate from one another and also separate from everything else in the world, but that's just an illusion. Ultimately, at the end of the day, we are all one thing, or at least that's what my very rudimentary understanding of Advaita tells me.
Okay, I can see why that might be an appealing view from one perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you accept that we're all really part of this ultimate, all-pervading unity, well, you're going to be more compassionate. You're going to be less selfish.
Yeah, or you'd just be really bored. Like, isn't variety the spice of life? Plus, what would make anyone believe that in the first place? I mean, doesn't the fact that you and I disagree show that we're not the same? If we were just a single thing, wouldn't we just have the same beliefs?
Real or not, Ray, you sure know how to ask the tough questions. And I bet our guest, Elisa Freschi from the University of Toronto, will definitely be able to answer them. She knows a heck of a lot more about all this stuff than I do.
Ooh, nice dodge there. Elisa is actually an expert on a different Hindu school of non-dual philosophy called Vishisht Advaita, but she also knows a lot about Advaita. So I'm really looking forward to learning more from her.
Me too. But first, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, on a mission to find out what some practitioners of non-duality have to say. She files this report.
The idea of oneness can seem so complicated, it's easy to joke about, but that doesn't always go over so well. Like in this segment of Australia's version of the Today Show, where the anchor tries to crack a joke with the Dalai Lama.
So the Dalai Lama walks into a pizza shop.
Cosa shop? Pizza
shop. Pizza?
Pizza shop, yes.
Yeah, pizza shop. And says, can you make me one with everything?
What's that? What's that?
Do you know
what? Oh, yes.
Do you know what I mean?
Knowing the definition of non-duality is a lot different than explaining it or understanding it.
Honestly, this is really about not knowing. It's not about knowing.
John Burney is a modern spiritual teacher and former Zen monk. When he was 16 years old, he had a spiritual awakening. The year was 1969.
I was a teenager. I was, you know, screwed up as any other 16-year-old, if not more. And I had a lot of growing and evolving to do before I had a perspective of what had happened to me and what was happening to me.
He was a concert violinist and would practice 2 to 4 hours a day. He remembers looking down at his hands.
Going, how is it doing that? Yes, I've learned, but there was a deeper questioning of how does life work?
Decades later, Burney now supports people all over the world who are, as he puts it, looking to learn how to facilitate the natural emergence of consciousness.
When we learn how to tune in deeply without a bunch of preconceived ideas, agendas, expectations, and so forth, naturally what happens is a kind of balancing of the nervous system, a kind of healing.
Over the last few decades, researchers have scanned the brains of Buddhist monks in meditation studies, hoping to learn more. Burney likes new experiences, so he signed up to have his brain scanned at UC San Diego years ago. He says the scanner was quite a contraption.
Like some draconian bank vault. And I'd wish they'd had invited me the day before just to get used to this incredibly uncomfortable position. I said, you know, I'm not sure I can really relax in this thing.
And more young people seem to be reaching out to him to learn about oneness. The internet and social media make it easy to find a practitioner focused on this work.
We used to say, oh, don't talk to yourself, you're crazy. And now we're like, no, please talk to yourself. Talk to yourself a whole bunch. Dialogue.
Dr. Josie Valderrama is a clinical psychologist in San Francisco. She works with people of color, LGBTQ+ people, activists, and artists, and helps them reach states that are less polarized. People close their eyes, and she uses sounds and movement to guide them.
So maybe we'll be doing some drumming or some playing of the different sound bowls, you know, like the crystal bowls and the Tibetan bowls.
She says non-duality is especially meaningful at a time when the world can feel split into two sides.
The more that we embody non-duality, the more I think that we can sort of transcend this divide and conquer programming that's out there, and that we can really connect and empower from sort of the ground up.
If you're still confused about oneness, now is a good time to turn to Pax, a novel about a friendship between a boy, Peter, and his fox, Pax. In the book, Peter goes on a journey to rescue his friend. Peter describes a feeling of merging with Pax the Fox. A character named Vola tells Peter he's experienced the Buddhist concept of two, but not two. Vola picks up a wooden fox and says,
"This is not just a piece of wood. This is also the clouds that brought the rain that watered the tree, and the birds that nested in it, and the squirrels that fed on its nuts. It is also the food that my grandparents fed me, that made me strong enough to cut the tree, and it's the steel and the axe I used. And it's how you know your fox, which allowed you to carve him yesterday."
And Vola says, "It's the story you will tell your children when you give this to them. All these things are separate, but also one." When you put it that way, it doesn't seem so hard to comprehend. And while the idea may not be about knowing, a basic understanding is not a bad place to begin. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
Thanks for that great report, Holly. I'm Josh Landy. With me is my Stanford colleague, Ray Briggs, and today we're thinking about non-duality and the oneness of being.
We're joined now by Elisa Freschi. She's a professor of philosophy at the University of Toronto and author of Duty, Language, and Exegesis in Prabhakara Mimamsa. Elisa, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks for having me.
Elisa, you're an Italian who's now teaching in Canada. How did you end up becoming an expert in Sanskrit philosophy?
Okay, so there is an Indian poem called Padmavat, where a prince falls in love with a girl just because he heard a parrot speaking about her. He leaves everything, including his kingdom, just in order to reach her, and ultimately they marry. And my story is somehow similar because I heard my ancient Greek teacher at high school, so I was 15 at that point, mentioning Sanskrit roots, and I just fell in love. I bought a book, which was called Teach Yourself Sanskrit, but through which I guess no one has ever been able to learn Sanskrit on their own. So after spending a summer on that, I just realized it was a failure and I started attending Sanskrit classes at the local university, much to the disappointment of all my other teachers at high school, which would have preferred, would have preferred me to come to school instead.
So Elisa, earlier I was having a really hard time understanding non-duality. And needless to say, I blame Josh for that. But can you explain it to me better than he did?
That's a challenge, but I'll try my best. So the basic point is that the only thing that ultimately exists and that ultimately is real is Brahman. Now, that's fine, and this applies to all Vedantic schools, so Vishishtadvaita Vedanta as well as Advaita Vedanta. The tricky part is what does ultimately mean when we say that the only thing that ultimately is real is Brahman. So for Advaita Vedanta, it means that only Brahman exists and everything else is illusory, including the chairs and everything else you mentioned. For Vishishtadvaita Vedanta, by contrast, it means that nothing exists independently of the Brahman.
So, and could you say just quickly, I mean, maybe this is a crazy question, but could you at least characterize Brahman a little bit briefly?
Again, it depends a lot on whether we are in Advaita Vedanta or Vishishtadvaita Vedanta. But in
Let's start in Advaita Vedanta. Let's start there.
Okay, that's going to be easy then, because the only characterization is that there are no characterizations.
That's why I thought it was a crazy question.
Because as soon as we would have any characterization, we would break the non-duality. So if we were to say that the Brahman is, I don't know, omniscient, omnipotent, or whatever, we would have one thing separated from another one. So no way. So the only thing we can approach it is by thinking of it as pure contentless consciousness. So it's not a consciousness which is thinking about stuff, because if it were thinking about stuff, then there would be stuff to think about, there would be contents, and there would be non-duality again. By contrast, it's just pure consciousness.
So the ultimate reality underneath all of the stuff that we see that's an illusion is pure contentless consciousness.
Yes.
So I'm having a little bit of trouble understanding Brahman still. Because usually when I want to understand something, I want to sort of list properties that it has. It seems like anything I can say about Brahman, if I distinguish it from another possible thing, counts as embracing duality, which I can't do. Is that right?
That's very much correct. And that's a point that also Sanskrit philosophers of language pointed out, namely all sentences about the Brahman need to be metaphorical. You can never describe it directly.
Can I get a metaphorical description?
Yeah. So the standard one would be it is existent, consciousness, and bliss. But of course, this cannot be real descriptions of the Brahman. They're just sort of like via negativa ways of approaching it.
I mean, those sound really nice, actually. Am I allowed to say that Brahman is good, or is that dual too?
It is dual, but I hope we'll have time to come to that. It's important that Brahman is ultimately bliss. I mean, it's something desirable to be in Brahman. Otherwise, it would be, as you said in the premise, very boring.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about Indian theories of non-duality with Elisa Freschi from the University of Toronto.
Can we trust our senses? Or are the objects we perceive just an illusion? What would make someone think that there's only one thing?
Oneness, illusion, and ultimate reality, along with your comments and questions when Philosophy Talk continues. What more can we say about non-duality? Quite a lot, I suspect. I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs, and we're thinking about non-duality and the oneness of being with Elisa Freschi from the University of Toronto.
We're still pre-recording the program from our respective homes, and unfortunately, we can't take your phone calls today. But you can always email us at comments@philosophytalk.org, or you can comment on our website, where you can also become a subscriber and gain access to our archive of more than 500 episodes.
So, Elisa, it sure seems like there are a lot of things around us. In light of that, can you help us understand non-duality? Why would somebody believe that there's only one thing?
Yeah, there are two sources for that. On the one hand, there are passages in the Upanishads, so in the sacred text of the Advaita Vedanta school, well accepted by all Vedantic schools, telling us that the only thing that exists is Brahman and that Atman is ultimately identical with it. But philosophically more interesting is the second point, namely that naive realism, the one which dictates us the existence of beds, desks, et cetera, is really naive. And it's really hard to maintain in a sound way that mid-sized objects like the ones I mentioned ultimately exist. And Sanskrit philosophers by the time Advaita Vedanta developed had already reached atomism, and some Buddhist opponents had already shown that atomism is also weak because of some, sorry for the difficult word, mereological weaknesses. It's really hard to imagine how atoms can connect to other things unless they have parts. But if they have parts, then they're no longer the smallest elements. So the alternatives are either you go in the direction of emptiness or mind only, which are both pursued in two schools of Buddhism, or Brahman only. And that would be Advaita Vedanta.
Okay, so there was a lot there, and I want to ask to unpack some of it. So it sounds like one of the good reasons for believing in non-duality is because all of the alternatives are bad, and reason can tell us that, in addition to sort of scripture telling us that non-duality is true. So the first alternative you mentioned was naive realism. Can you spell that out a little bit more?
Yeah, I'm just imagining naive realism as the one we would all subscribe to as untrained people, namely thinking that, I don't know, handkerchiefs, books, desks, computers, beds, pictures, et cetera, so all these mid-sized objects ultimately exist. However, as soon as you start your philosophical journey or your scientific journey, this belief will be crushed by the fact that it's really hard to maintain their existence, given the fact that they're made of smaller parts.
Wait. So why can't like bats exist and be made of like wings and little bat faces and wool and all these smaller parts? Like isn't that a consistent view?
Yeah, that's true. But let us take an example we'll be all familiar with coming from, say, a scientific background. So a chair. A chair is made of a set of atoms, but of course, there is no clear definition, clear distinctions between the atoms which are leaving the chair at every second and new atoms which are accruing to it due to chemical combinations. So the thing which looks solid to us and persistent through time is in fact not at all solid. It is dynamic and moving through time and becoming at every second something else. And this is something that Buddhist opponents had already realized, and they had already challenged the naive realists within Sanskrit philosophy, such as the Nyaya school and the Mimamsa school, telling them, look, that's not going to work. You have to use more basic elements, which Sanskrit, let us say Hindu schools also did by embracing atomism. But then Adam is also has its weaknesses, like the ones we were mentioning before. So it seems like no matter how far you go, you'll never come to this solid reality you can sort of like hold on and rely upon.
So, okay, but let's get back to, okay, so you've given us a really fascinating reason for embracing this theory, but let's flesh it out just a little bit more. So what we've got on the table for Advaita, for non-dualism, is that there's an illusion that we all seem to have, that we are, you know, we're real and there's multiplicity, there's lots of us and there's lots of objects and animals and computers and all that kind of stuff. None of that's real. The only real reality, the ultimate reality, is Brahman. You can't really say much about it, but what you can say is that it's unitary. There's no plurality in it. So there aren't two things, right? The world of Brahman and our world. There's only one thing, Brahman. That's the real reality. And there isn't plurality because plurality is just an illusion. I think I understand that so far. Now, the one thing I'm still a little confused about is Atman. Right? Somehow, we humans, or more than just humans, we have something like a soul, and this soul is really Brahman. Can you say a little bit more about that part of Advaita?
Sure. The first thing you sort of like hinted at is also cool, namely, not just humans. So there is no privileged state in being a human being. And we are talking about Atman as encompassing from Brahma, so from deities, up to a thread of grass. So everything, animals, all sorts of animals, et cetera, et cetera. This being said, you're right. So basically, we believe to be separated souls. The sort of like the nerdy part of me would like to say separate selves, as to translate Atman. But in fact, as soon as the Maya, as soon as this illusion is destroyed, we will be revealed as part of Brahman only. In fact, as identical with Brahman.
So who's experiencing an illusion if I'm not real?
That's a very cool question. And that's the status of illusion is exactly the sort of like the main problem of Advaita Vedanta. Because of course, Maya, so the word for illusion, cannot be real. Otherwise, we would no longer have duality. But it cannot be completely unreal. Otherwise, we wouldn't have illusion at all. So the answer is it is anirvachaniya, a nice Sanskrit word, which means we don't know. So literally, it means it is unexpressible. In the sense that its ontological status is ambiguous. Somehow. Mm.
So if I understand right, the kind of Vedanta that you study, Vashishta Advaita, has a different answer to this question about the status of illusion than Advaita does. Is that right? And how does that work?
It has a completely different answer. For Advaita Vedanta, the relation between Brahman and the world is completely illusory. So there is no relation, and the only reality is Brahman. Whereas for Vishishtadvaita Vedanta, the world is ultimately real, only it is not independently real. It is real only as a characteristic, as a specification of Brahman. So this is also the reason why it is called Vishishtadvaita, so qualified Advaita, insofar as it is an Advaita plus qualifications. And you, me, everything else is a qualification of the Brahman.
Okay, I see. So I'm kind of familiar with other places in philosophy where you might have things that are real but not ultimately real. So if I'm watching a movie on a screen, you might think like the images of people running by are sort of real. I can point out where they are, but they're kind of ultimately just like light shining through film. Is that a good metaphor?
This looks like a better metaphor for Advaita Vedanta than it would be for Vishishta Advaita Vedanta. And in fact, Advaita Vedanta did use a similar metaphor to explain the relation between Brahman and Maya, namely the dream case. So in a dream, we do experience plenty of stuff. We see objects, we have experiences, et cetera, et cetera. But all those things do not ultimately exist. They are supportless, baseless. And after a certain amount of time, we wake up and we realize it was just a dream. None of that was real. Similarly, we will wake up as Brahman and realize that everything we have experienced that far was just an illusion.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about non-duality and the oneness of being with Elisa Freschi from the University of Toronto. And we have an email from Robert on our website. Robert asks, I'm interested in an analysis of what non-duality could possibly mean in the context of knowledge about physical reality and the brain-mind relationship. What is mind? How can things non-trivially be one? What does this really mean without vague hand-waving, kumbaya, unjustifiable statements like we are all interconnected or consciousness is everywhere? A feisty question from Robert. What do you say to that, Elisa?
I guess you'll find more interesting stuff outside of Advaita Vedanta, but let me sort of like gesture towards an answer. Well, first of all, in most Sanskrit philosophical schools, there is a denial of physicalism. So the brain is not the mind, full stop. And even Buddhist schools where you would suspect physicalism to be an option, straightforwardly deny it. So plenty of material about it. Brain is not our go-to. If we go for Advaita Vedanta on top of that, well, in fact, even the mind is an illusion. So all our mental activities, cognitions of stuff, et cetera, it's abolitions, conations, et cetera, those are also illusory. And in fact, the only thing which basically exists is this underlying consciousness. I hope we'll have time to come to that at a certain point, but we do have one element, one experience in our lives in which we do experience that. So there is somehow an empirical proof for that as well.
Right. So I wonder if Vishishta Advaita gives more opportunities for saying stuff about the relationship between the mind and the body than Advaita does. So it seems like if I believe in Advaita, I have to say, oh, they're not real. Or maybe they're the same thing. They're both Brahman. But if they're both derivative of Brahman, but still real in some sense, does that mean I can say that they're different things? Like, is there more room to distinguish different things in Vishishtadvaita?
Absolutely. So first of all, you're right. There are conscious things and unconscious things that are both attributes of Brahman. So there are two kinds of attributes, but both of them are real. And you're right that embodiment is much more of a topic for Vishishtadvaita Vedanta. For obvious reasons, it couldn't be a topic for Advaita Vedanta. And it is a topic both for epistemological purposes and for soteriological purposes. So as far as the epistemology goes, we experience through our body. So that's, it's really important to be embodied in order to have experience. That's also why we are said to be God's body. So God can experience the word. Oh, sorry, I should have said that God is the same as Brahman for this school. So God can experience the word via us as his body.
Okay, so assume that I'm a very ignorant person, which would be an excellent assumption. So we're thinking now about the difference between Advaita Vedanta and Vishishtadvaita Vedanta. So two sub-schools, right, within Hindu philosophy. So far we've mostly been talking about Advaita Vedanta. Now we're shifting to Vishishtadvaita Vedanta, where the world is still real, but it's somehow just the body of God. And God is Brahman, but God is, I take it, also Vishnu. Help me out here. What's going on? The world is real, and yet it's sort of, but there's still a kind of non-duality because it's real in a special way. It's real only as the body of Brahman.
That's very good. I mean, that's more than I would have expected from all of my students.
From a really ignorant person.
No. Way better than that. No, you are absolutely on the right track. So yes, I mean, an obvious similarity would be that with pantheism. However, it's not completely like pantheism. So let us start with pantheism and we'll go beyond that. So just like in pantheism, you can imagine the word as being God's body. And you're right, there is a dual assumption here. So God is on the one hand a personal figure, and we'll come to that later. And it is also the absolute Brahman as we encountered it in Advaita Vedanta. So that's fine. And in this sense, I think if we think in terms of pantheism, it makes sense to imagine that that God or the Brahman can experience via the word, because the word is his body. It goes a little bit beyond that, because in most forms of pantheism, there is nothing beyond the word which God could encompass, whereas to make stuff more difficult, Ramanuja, so the main one of the main figures of Vishishtadvaita Vedanta, speaks about Brahman as being in the world, but also beyond it.
So actually, this mention of pantheism brings me directly to one of our other listener questions. So Andrew in Oakland asks whether you'd be willing to discuss similarities and differences between Vishishtadvaita Vedanta and the monist philosophy of Spinoza, who is a pantheist.
Very good question. The only challenge will be to keep it short. So you're right, and both agree in not denying the reality of the world, and both agree insofar as they think that things that are usually identified as independent substances by coeval philosophers, so Descartes in the case of Spinoza and the Nyaya school in the case of Vishishtadvaita Vedanta, are instead equated to attributes. So modus or affectio in Spinoza and Visheshana in the Vishishtadvaita Vedanta, and whose attributes are there, are they their attributes of God, which is the only ultimately independent substance. Consequently, Spinoza and Vishishtadvaita Vedanta explicitly also agree in the possibility of attributes of attributes. So I am an attribute of God, but I also have, say, blonde hair. So it seems like an attribute of God can have attributes itself. And both Spinoza and Ramanuja agree that the single reality, which is God, has two sorts of attributes, namely conscious and unconscious ones. So mens and extensio in Spinoza. So far, so good. Give me one more second to say that there are at least some differences. Well, first of all, Spinoza seems to uphold the existence of two orders of predication, so attributes and modes. Uh-huh. The first ones would be the laws of nature, and the other one, so being eternal and necessary, et cetera, et cetera. This distinction doesn't seem to be there in Vishishtadvaita Vedanta, just like the importance of necessity for Spinoza seems to be completely lacking. So the idea that all is necessary is not there in Vishishtadvaita Vedanta. And the second point is God and knowledge. So for Spinoza, mens and extensio are two alternative modes of God. This is not the case for Vishishtadvaita Vedanta.
So that's a lot of differences. I was curious about sort of modality, which is sort of talk about possibility and how that's different. I know Spinoza thinks that God could not have been different than God is, and nothing could have been different than it is. So does Vishishtadvaita Vedanta disagree with that or just not say much about it?
I would say that they disagree with that, but we have to consider in the background an important point, namely that the whole world theory of possible worlds, et cetera, has not been developed in Sanskrit philosophy. So it's a major theme in European philosophy. It is not such in Sanskrit philosophy. So it's the emphasis on all is necessary and nothing is contingent is a major step for Spinoza. Its denial is less major for Vishishtadvaita Vedanta. So that would be the first part of the answer. The second part of the answer is that God is also a personal God. So it's not just Brahman, it's also a personal God, and therefore can act freely.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about non-duality and the oneness of being with Elisa Freschi from the University of Toronto.
If we're all just one, then why is there so much inequality in the world? Shouldn't salvation be for everyone? If we all embraced the oneness of being, would the world be a better place?
All for oneness and oneness for all. Plus commentary from Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher, when Philosophy Talk continues. It's just an illusion. If it's all just an illusion, do I really have to fold my laundry? I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Accept your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs. Our guest is Elisa Freschi from the University of Toronto, and we're thinking about non-duality and the oneness of being.
And we've got another email. It's from Peter in West Yorkshire in the UK, and I will not try to do the accent, even though it's an accent that I love. Peter asks about non-dual philosophy beyond Hinduism. He says it's explicitly endorsed by Nagarjuna, middleweight Buddhism, by Lhotse, Meister Eckhart, Al-Halaj, and more generally, the perennial philosophy. It's found in all traditions and is the foundation of mysticism and explains it. So what do you think about that, Elisa?
In this case, I have to say that I disagree. But the questioner is in good company. I mean, my friend and colleague and co-founder of the Indian philosophy blog, Amod Lele, thinks exactly in the same way that non-dualism should be real because it's part of perennial philosophy. Everyone has been thinking about it, et cetera, et cetera. So the questioner might want to check his blog posts about it. In my case, I tend to think that in order to see the similarities, you have to be so far away from the specific cases of each one of the thinkers they mentioned that everything looks similar. So
30,000 feet, it looks the same, but when you get exactly. A little bit closer.
Yeah, exactly.
So Elisa, I've heard that if we want to have a direct experience of non-duality, we have to do all this preparatory work, like studying and meditating and so on. And it sort of sounds to me like that would only be available to relatively privileged people. But if we're all part of the same ultimate reality, shouldn't salvation be accessible to everyone?
That's a cool question. And in fact, it is a problem because for Shankara, so the main thinker of Advaita Vedanta, it's exactly as you say. So ultimately, there is no way to reach non-duality apart from the Upanishadic path. So reciting the Upanishadic sentences, which will lead you to this immediate understanding of non-duality. But of course, this means that we are cutting off everyone who has no access to Vedic learning, to recitation of the Upanishads. But we were talking also about Vishishtadvaita Vedanta, who has a different answer to this problem, namely that of suggesting a different religious path called prapatti, which literally means surrender. And this path is open to everyone, including low-class people who can't recite the Veda, women, etc., etc. And in order to surrender, and surrender is to God, you need to realize that you have no other shelter than God. So somehow, being of a high class, learned and conversant with the Vedas can even be an obstacle in your soteriological path because you might overestimate yourself and your chances. So somehow, prapatti suggests us epistemic and religious humility.
That's really nice. You know, one thing that leapt out at me in thinking about all this is that the three different subschools of Vedanta seem to have a different approach to who can, in fact, find liberation. And it seems to me, if I understand correctly, that Dvaita Vedanta, the dualist form, doesn't hold that everyone can find liberation. It seems to hold that some people just, you know, for whatever reason, they're sort of marked out, maybe predestined, some Protestants might say, not to be able to find liberation. Whereas it sounds like within Vishishtadvaita Vedanta, it's available to everybody. Is that about right?
That's very correct. Yes, exactly. For Dvaita Vedanta, they are Nitya Samsarins people. So people who will remain in samsara forever. It's in their nature. They will not be able to go beyond it. By contrast, within Vishishtadvaita Vedanta, the idea is that God's mercy is endless and he is not only open to help you, he's in fact actively looking for a small excuse to help you. Mm. There are plenty of nice stories about God saving one just because they by chance utter them in.
So this idea that enlightenment is available to everybody, it sounds really nice. But I kind of struggle to reconcile it with the actual inequality we see in things like the caste system. And in fact, most of the rest of the world having its own versions of inequality. So if we're all really equally aspects of Brahman or like modes of Brahman, why do some of us have to suffer more than others? That doesn't seem fair.
It's a very complex question because you're ranging from social issues to theodicy. So I'll try to give a short answer to both. On the one hand, you're right. The social issues are very much a problem. And in fact, within Vishishtadvaita Vedanta, there has been a dynamic evolution about thinking about castes. And many Vishishtadvaita Vedanta authors think in a social reforming way that we are all loved by God and parts of God's body, so that castes shouldn't matter at all. And in fact, one of the main thinkers of the Vishishtadvaita Vedanta school, Nammalva, was himself a Shudra, so a member of the lowest class, and everyone loves him and reverts him. So this possibility is very much part of the tradition. although it's not the only approach. The other one being there are different paths. Prapatti, surrender is the one for low-class people, and reading the Veda is the one for high-class people. So that's one part. Mm-hmm. The other part is, how is evil possible at all? How is suffering at all possible? That's such a cool topic, and it's going to be hard for me to keep it short. But let us say that we have at least two ingredients here. One is karma. So the karma you have been accumulating through your previous births. And the other one is freedom. So somehow evil is the price that can be paid in order to be freely loved. So God accepts that evil will be part of the world because he wants a free given love from us.
Right. So is there anyone who says that suffering is okay because it's illusory? So you just told us earlier that Advaita Vedanta thinks that lots of things that we think are real are in fact illusions. And I was wondering if that might extend to suffering.
Absolutely, yes. If you're an Advaita Vedantin, basically the pain you're experiencing now, including physical pain, is just illusory. The problem is that you're identifying so much with your body, with your current state, namely, I don't know, being in a precarious job situation, in a difficult love relationship, et cetera, that you'll suffer a pain which, in fact, you're just self-inflicting to yourself, and it's not there.
To go back to the politics a little bit, I mean, you could imagine, on the one hand, you can imagine various forms of Advaita leading to an impetus for social change. I mean, I know Adi Shankara says that, you know, caste and class are just errors. And so you could imagine that leading to some kind of movement for progress. Or on the other hand, you could imagine it being quietist, right? Well, look, everything's an illusion. Even suffering's an illusion. So turn inward and focus on your life, so to speak. Of course, that's not entirely yours, right? It's the universe's. But so where do you think we end up? Do you think we end up within Advaita Vedanta in a more kind of politically, progressive, so to speak, position, or more a kind of quietist, get on with it and try to reach liberation as opposed to changing society?
Well, historically, both paths have been followed. So we have had both Advaita Vedantins claiming that Vedic learning is the path and there is no other way. Why so? Because all our instruments of knowledge, all our other sources of knowledge are so much ingrained in illusion that there is no way to go beyond this illusion unless we have a completely different source. And this completely different source is the Upanishads. Everything else we might think about is based on illusion and will not get us out of illusion. However, as you rightly said, social reformers have also used Advaita Vedanta as a way to say that, in fact, castes are illusory and therefore should be overcome. And I'm not entering into the whole discussion of whether we should translate Jati as caste. Let us just take it as it is.
Okay.
So I am not going to go read Vedic scriptures because I'm not going to go read any scriptures. I'm also not going to suffer the way that somebody in a worse position would suffer. Is there any hope for me? Or am I just never going to achieve the kind of enlightenment and non-duality that defenders of Vishishta Advaita Vedanta or Advaita Vedanta or any other kind of Vedanta think that I should achieve?
Well, I mean, I was reading with students on Friday Apadeva's commentary on the essence of Vedanta, and he has, within the preliminary steps, there are some very clearly marked steps, such as having learned the Veda by heart, but that's not the main point. The main point is having recognized that something is permanent and something is impermanent, and having developed a distaste for everything which is impermanent. So people like me, who are still very much interested into reading new books, experiencing new stuff, traveling and seeing new things, I'm really low in this soteriological.
Sounds really hard. I like so many impermanent things. I love food.
On the other hand, I mean, there's one thing we were mentioning, I sort of hinted at before and I didn't develop enough, but which could be useful here. Namely, we do have, all of us, we each single person among us has had an experience of Brahman in deep sleep. So yeah. When we are in dreamless sleep, the nice feeling of, well, bliss, allegedly, which makes us say after once we wake up, oh, I slept well, that was the experience of Brahman. So we could develop a taste for that and start from there.
I've got to agree. I should put a card on the table, which is, you know, I'm not just fascinated by this, but I do sometimes feel this is just the reality. But let me get clear before we let you go on what that reality is. If I understand correctly, the picture of a Vishishtadvaita is something like this. Look, Elisa Fresky is one thing made up of a soul and a body, and so too God is one thing made up of Brahman and then the physical world. And both of those are real, but they're really part of the same thing. And God gets to experience through us, through everything that is also sort of real. But okay, so then what is God experiencing in this picture?
We are in the world of to on polakos legatai, if I can use Aristotle. So plurality is the world is manifold and plurality is real. So the Brahman, and by the way, Brahman encompasses both the material side as far as the consciousness side. So it's not that the Brahman has a body; it is its own body. So the Brahman.
So it's sort of experiencing itself in a sense.
Well, all of its manifold attributes. So it's just like, I mean, imagine you having a body which continuously transforms itself, and you can sort of like blissfully look at it while it's changing every time.
Sounds pretty great. Elisa, it's been real, I think. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Our guest has been Elisa Fresky, professor of philosophy at the University of Toronto and author of Duty, Language, and Exegesis in Prabhakara Mimamsa. So Ray, what are you thinking now?
Well, I decided to channel the ancient sage John Perry and write a limerick. You might think we see a plurality of objects, but that's not reality. The raindrops, the sun, my left foot, they're all one and unreal. So embrace non-duality.
I like your mentality. I don't know. I'm going to have to work on my Perryisms. We will put links to everything we've mentioned today and to Ray's limerick on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can also become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send it to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we may feature it on the blog.
Now, Brahman is speed. Speed is Brahman. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, I picked up a copy of David Lynch's biography, and of course, there's a bit of strangeness to it. Christine McKenna, his longtime interviewer, so the book jacket tells me, wrote the biography, the chapters of which are interspersed with David Lynch interrogating the biography, as they say these days, correcting impressions, expanding on details. Much has been said and much made in the book about Lynch and transcendental meditation. He used and uses TM as a way to get rid of anger, which makes a lot of sense. Hard to be angry when you have a mantra going on. He blames dualism for all the anger in the world. This might even be true. But getting rid of dualism would be frustrating, which itself could lead to anger. I know that it took two people to write this book about one person. Lynch's movies seem to be embodiments of worlds utterly lacking peace and tranquility, depicting, I would say, the perils, terrors, and delights of the dualist universe. Kyle MacLachlan on your right, Dennis Hopper on your left, milkshakes and martinis, sock hops and Heineken, amnesia and painful memories, severed ears and waving firemen under one umbrella. In that sense, his movies are quite realistic. It's hard to think of a world without dualism, male, female, right, left, eye, ear, up, down, light, dark, and more abstractly in concepts like the king's two bodies. There's the man and the office, you see. The presidency goes forward unchanging through time, even as presidents drop by the wayside or issue bizarre statements from Florida. There are many dualisms, the mind-body thing, now, never, was, not was, here, not here. All of this is illusion, which is either a scientific opinion or a mystical epiphany, depending on your bent. It can't be proven, really, only experienced. It seems weird, though, that with TM, meditation requires a mantra. In the dualist world, that would be called a tool. The mantra is given to you by your guru, licking the tool from the hardware store. The plan seems to be to meditate yourself into a dreamless state, where you're conscious in the blankness of now, comatose but aware, dreaming the world, gazing at everything which has been revealed to be nothing. Well, I've never gone down that road, but I have gone down the opposite, trying to be aware of as much as I can to become one with everything, as the joke goes. Once you know the alphabet, for example, you know all there is to know. The words are right there. You just have to dig them out. So I'm not sure I'm the kind of guy who can bust out of the prison of the self, frankly. I can't be truly free because the jail never existed. It's just an illusion. But I know what a jail is. even though it's not real, so maybe it can still escape through a subtle shift in nomenclature, or can I? Blind in one eye, you'll still see what other people are seeing, unless it's a 3D movie, and those movies are a waste of money anyway. Use your own mantra. Don't judge. If you're wrong, don't think about it. Not your fault. We are now not that thing, or that other thing. We are all things, which is nothing. Of course, you are still that which is knowing, that which can't be known. So maybe only exists in your own mind, which may be all that exists, unless it's part of the thing at which it's looking, which could perhaps confer thingness upon things which are not that thing. The point is, you never know. It's considered a flaw to not realize we are part of nature, but we're not part of all nature, are we? We can't live in the ocean. Mollusks can't go to college. And denying duality seems to prove it exists, or did, doesn't it? You need legs to have a limb. Breaking your arm doesn't mean you're left-handed. Consciousness is our blessing and our curse, or pie and coffee, again, depending on whether there's a seat next to Asian Cooper at Bob's Big Boy. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW Local Public Radio San Francisco and the trustees of Leland Stanford Jr. University. Copyright 2021.
Our executive producer is Tina Pamantuan.
The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research, and Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler and Angela Johnston.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed, or misexpressed, on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can subscribe to our library of more than 500 episodes. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
I'm wearing dark glasses today because I'm seeing the future and it's looking very bright.